these flakes and losers became billionaires. It's just irritating.
You know, I came in late to that conversation, but I can't agree more.
It's time for the Access It Easy podcast.
I'm going to do a roll-in. So welcome everyone to the third Access of Easy Salon, this time with all three of us here. Charles Hugh Smith from Hawaii, Jesse Hirsch from the Ottawa Valley, and I'm in West Toronto. And we are going to talk about, well, I don't know. I've got a few topics. I'm sure we all do. Jesse, where do you want to start today?
Well, I'm particularly interested in talking to Charles about his survival strategies and the way in which one plans for multiple scenarios. But what I found particularly interesting about that post is the idea that while we should be planning for catastrophe, we also need to hedge for it not actually happening and for everything continuing as it were. And I think that provides a really interesting metaphor for moving forward in an era of uncertainty. As for my own interests, I spent the morning thinking about privacy and kind of questioning or interrogating whether, in fact, our privacy attitudes have changed as a result of this crisis, or whether they're still as strong as they used to be. And I think both speak to the paradox that is involved in living in a moment where we have access to so much information, but we still have no clue as to what's going on.
Charles? What's on your mind this week?
Well, for my little topic of the day, I used this metaphor a couple of weeks ago about the airliner, you know, has a flight envelope, right? And doesn't really do well outside of that envelope. And in fact, you know, long outside of that envelope, it crashes. And I think what I wanted to talk about was the idea that our system, the status quo or the socioeconomic system, the flight envelope is just narrowing down to where the aircraft has to be in exactly the right speed, exactly the right altitude. Everything has to be within like millimeters. That's all that's left. You know, that's, in other words, there's no wiggle room left. And that, of course, is the definition of fragility as opposed to Taleb's anti-fragility. Other topics, what I liked about Jesse's phrase, or that his exploration of the idea that technology is been automated, but it's not responsible. And I thought that was a really interesting use of the word, not competent or, you know, responsible. And then it's like, wow, nobody even thinks that technology should be responsible. And of course, that kind of ties into Jesse's ideas of there's no magic bullets and there's no humility. So, you know, we get this system where this arrogance, you know, the arrogant aristocracy of technology is always presenting magic bullets without humility or responsibility. And then Mark, that to me, that kind of ties into your exploration of uncertainty. And it calls to mind the old Gulf War exploration of the known knowns, the known unknowns, and then the unknown unknowns. And I think the radical uncertainty is where we're at, because it's like there's a lot of unknown unknowns, and the system doesn't really do well with those.
Right. And on my side, Charles, I don't know if Jesse and I are talking about the same article, but one of the ones you republished three from the past, and I remember the 2008 one where you were talking about, you know, I don't know if you used, you know, the definition of true social capital in that article, or if you introduced that exact concept later, I can't remember. But I remember reading that article in 2008, and the reason I remember it so viscerally was because I was one of those guys who thought like that, and still am. You know, I just need a place out in the country where I can have my guns, gold, and provisions, and somehow we'll be fine while the rest of the world around us burns. And then the alternate version of that is, if I can just, you know, own my villa in Barbados, then I can just do it down there where it's warmer. And when I read that article of yours, I realized you know, the guys, I didn't know you at the time either, but I remember thinking, he's right. Like, he is absolutely right about this. And then fast forward to now, when we were, when this whole crisis broke out, I was really kind of kicking myself because I always still wanted to have a place outside of the city, and we don't have one yet. My daughter and I are looking through ads for cottages and stuff, and I said to my wife, you know, even if we pulled the trigger on one of these and bought one of these places over March break when all this was starting to happen, we get up there, we're just some gringos from the city who don't know anything, and we have no ties to the community, and we have no roots on the ground there, and we'd really be twisting more in the wind out there than we would be here in Etobicoke, where we have connections and networks and social networks. I don't mean Facebook social networks. I mean on the ground social networks. I know a couple of butchers who, you know, I could call them up. And so that article sort of came back from the past to haunt me. And Jesse, you were talking about how our critical thinking skills are a muscle like any other muscle, and it's use it or lose it. And it kind of made me think it's not even use it or lose it. We've actively abrogated our critical thinking skills. You get punished for using them now, is what I find is happening. And, you know, we can maybe talk about that. I've been kind of a little obsessed with narrative still, the whole what is true, we don't know, just because I see, and it's become so distorted and so over amplified that it has this negative effect on me, this declining return on me, where if I read it in the mainstream news, my first reaction is, I don't believe this. So, yeah, I mean, those are my 3 points for this week. I made a couple of notes while you guys were talking about yours, but we can get into those as the conversation goes on. I'll say one thing. What Charles was talking about, how the range of motion for the system is so brittle that it's getting tighter and tighter and tighter together. I'm not a day trader or a technical analyst by any stretch of the imagination, but I do know the concept of Bollinger Bands in technical analysis, where it sort of shows the top and bottom range for a trading range of a stock or financial instrument. And as they come closer together over time, as the Bollinger Bands constrict, it portends a breakout. And what technical analysts don't know is whether that breakout's going to be to the upside or to the downside. So either everything is going to break out and become amazingly well, you know, the stock is going to go up, or it's going to crash and implode. And I tend to sometimes use technical analysis metaphors for life. And so that's what you reminded me of when you were talking about that constricting range of movement within a system.
Well, I think, Mark, to build off your point about critical thinking and the extent to which it's either atrophied or we've outsourced it or deferred it, I mean, it's never an on-off switch. It's I think what's missing in this entire crisis is nuance. And, you know, while I obviously, perhaps foolishly, hope for that nuance from institutions, I think as individuals, it's easier to be able to find that nuance. And it applies to any issue. You know, on the one hand, I think it applies to the way in which this narrative is playing out, that there are dominant narratives being sort of put forward by governments and by corporate media. And there are dissenting narratives that are coming from all sorts, all sides, all parts of the political spectrum. And I think part of the pressure is on us to be careful about our tendency to lose that nuance, to, as you were saying, assume that everything the media says is rubbish, when realistically it's probably 80% of what the media says is rubbish, but there's still 20% of reasonable and dare I call it, accurate information there. But I kind of thought of the same when you were talking about cottage country, in that, you know, I've only been living rurally for a couple of years, so I'm still relatively new on this learning curve. But one of the lessons that I quickly learned was the difference between cottage country and rural communities. Because in cottage country, there's a lot of tension between, you know, the seasonal residents, the people who come in the summer, and the townies, and the people who are there all along. And I'm not sure that those tensions are bridgeable in this crisis. In fact, they're getting worse. There's a lot of communities here in Ontario where they're trying to bar cottagers from coming. And I mean, that's actually illegal. The province as a whole is saying that you can't do that. And there's, I think, going to be a lot of court cases of people litigating just so that they have access to their property for insurance compliance, for pest maintenance, for, you know, making sure that everything's okay. In contrast to rural communities where the culture is so warm, so welcoming, so friendly, that, you know, with some exceptions, you can actually move to these communities without knowing anybody, and you will be welcomed into the local social support network. You know, part of it is these communities are desperate for people. So anyone who moves into the community ends up being regarded as a natural friend and a natural ally. But there is, as cliche as it sounds, a genuine culture of friendliness and compassion that, you know, as a someone who grew up in the city, this shocked me, and it's my instincts still run counter to it. But it is remarkable just how everyone is so openly friendly. You know, yesterday I had a tow truck driver come to pick up an old car of mine that I was sending out to be parted out. And he ended up staying for an hour as we talked about all these strategies in terms of off-grid living and ways in which you could raise your own food. And that's been my experience generally in living in a rural community, that there really is a significant openness and a significant sense of we're in it together that I find as a refreshing contrast to the time I spent in Toronto, which was anything but.
Yeah, let me interject here, or if I may.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because Charles, that article of yours that talked to exactly Jesse's point had a lot of great advice in it about that.
Yeah, and I just wanted to comment that what I see, the big difference between the kind of community that Jesse just described and the typical city or suburb is, number one, in the city or suburb, you don't really know your neighbors, or they're in the city. The denser your city environment, the more likely it is that your neighbors are moving, they're young, and so on and so forth. So it's like this a moving kaleidoscope of residents as opposed to stability. But even if they have lived there for years, it's like most people don't even extend themselves to know their neighbors, right? But more important than that is, what are you doing physically in the real world for that community? And the thing is, in a real community, people spend huge amounts of time, energy, money giving their stuff and labor, you know, and value to the community. And what I, and that's kind of like what I see in my life here, which is the goal, you know. I mean, hey, I have to walk the walk, right? I mean, it's easy to talk about community, but what it means is you don't get to spend 6 hours staring at a freaking screen. You got to get out there and do something and then give it away. And it's like, yeah, we spend hours, you know, baking stuff or making stuff to respond and reciprocate to people who brought a bunch of food by for us. And that's the local culture, which is actually just traditional culture, is you don't return any container that was given to you full of food or something worthwhile. You don't return it empty. And it can't just be some store-bought thing. No, that's like, it's like, what is that? You know? And so we, as a culture, and I'm speaking specifically of America, but you know, it's probably infiltrated or poisoned north and south as well, is it's all like, well, what am I gonna get for myself, right? Like where's it gonna benefit me? And of course, that mentality is totally toxic to actual community. And so what happens here in Hawaii is people from the mainland move here with that attitude, and then they're invited to a party or a gathering. They bring nothing, or they bring some cheap thing like a six-pack of beer or, you know, some store-bought crackers or something. And then other people have spent hours making real food. And it's all like, well, that's the last invitation that a-hole gets. I don't care how nice they are, you know, how chatty they are and all that stuff. Look, they already revealed who they were. And being friendly is not enough. So in other words, and it's just unbelievable when you compare a normal self-absorbed city dweller who does nothing for anyone. They might They might stop if they see somebody passed out on their sidewalk, but maybe not, because if the guy looks homeless, no, I'm not going to get involved. And so it's just shocking to me, compared to people who are embedded in real communities, they spend a huge amount of time, you know, in the community doing stuff for other people. And the standard person that's kind of like punditry talking about community does nothing, you know. And so it's you earn your place through hard work. So that's my point. Mm-hmm. And sorry, I thought I went on too long.
No.
We have all the time in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I know some, I don't even know what to call it, but I know some situations where people not only don't show up with food that they baked at home, they bring containers to take the leftovers with them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the mentality. Yeah. And so when you talk about like a lack of, I don't know, it's like a lack of cultural awareness that you're supposed to do something for other people and not expect some immediate benefit, that the pleasure is in the giving and the reciprocity, not in like, how much am I going to get out of this? And, you know, I often use the phrase in the, you know, it's dropped out of my vocabulary, but I often talked about the savior state, you know, and that the idea that the state's going to come in and make everything right and save me, so I don't have to do anything myself. And that kind of mentality is what's eroded real community. So,
I think that connects to technology, that concept of the savior state has kind of migrated more towards the technology industry, where government may still have the belief that it can be the savior, but it actually has outsourced that capacity to the technology world. Because government now believes that technology is what will save us. And as long as we have a technology solution, then, you know, that savior role can be preserved. But of course, it's all nonsense. It's all a myth that unless we're building that level of community capacity, unless we're fostering the kind of self-reliance that allows people them not to just think for themselves, but do for themselves, then, you know, it all ends up leading to this state of disappointment in which people, you know, keep looking for the savior and the savior doesn't come, and instead all you get is tragedy.
So this brings me to a point that I've been thinking about a lot lately. I've always loved that expression, the savior state, from the first time I ever read it. And the first thing that I ever wrote that actually got picked up by Zero Hedge was called The System of the World. It was about 6 or 7 years ago, and it said, the objective of the state is to make the population completely dependent on it. Because if they don't, if the population realizes they don't need the state, then that jeopardizes the existence of the state itself, at least in that form. And I think, you know, everybody knows this. And when I think about the logic behind the savior state, if you're going to accept it as a population, and I think we're being sort of conditioned to accept it, it's like, well, if my business shuts down, I'm going to get my paycheck protection checks sent to me. If I'm a big corporation and I'm going to go bankrupt because I spent all my money on share buybacks, I'm going to get a bailout. And, you know, no matter what happens, the government has my back. If stocks go down, they're going to announce another round of QE and push them back up again. Well, if that's the logic you're going to live by, then none of us really deserve any freedoms of any sort. Because if the state is underwriting our entire existence, then it kind of follows by logic that they get to call the shots. I mean, one of the things I think about, an example is here in Canada with universal health care, I've always thought, and it's sort of a devil's advocate argument, but it's a real one. It's like, why is smoking legal in Canada? All right. If health care is free, why are we underwriting a habit that we know is destructive to your health? So shouldn't smoking be illegal? That same argument goes across every sphere of life, of your day-to-day activities. If the state is going to completely underwrite your livelihood and your existence, then anything that you do or say that could actually undermine that or make it more expensive for the state to do that should be prohibited. I mean, that's that's where the logic gets you at the end. But there's no resiliency built into that. When everyone is self-reliant or everyone has a bit more of a cushion built into their own life, then all of those unknown unknowns have a chance to be absorbed by the population at large a bit more effectively than if it just blindsides the state and there's no trickle-down solution to defray that unknown unknown.
I mean, I'm skeptical of such a characterization because I feel that it skips some important nuance. I mean, for example, I think we overestimate the power of the state. I mean, I agree that the state's primary purpose is to legitimize itself, to demonstrate it how essential it is and how we cannot live without it. But it is also worth saying that there are an infinite possibility of states. Like there's everything from super authoritarian states to completely useless and almost invisible states. And I think if we assume that a democracy is the least worst of systems, you know, and in particular that the problem with dictatorships is that they just don't work. They're not efficient. That human beings do not actually respond to coercion. They don't like being manipulated. And the more you try to oppress them, the more that they're going to struggle to be free. This, to me, reinforces the value of social contracts, that you actually need to get the consent of the ruled to rule them effectively. And so your point about cigarettes, I think, is interesting because that has been a debate. And I think it also kind of parallels gun control debates that, you know, there's a lot of people who say nothing good could come from guns, therefore we should ban them. And of course, everyone who lives in a rural community says, well, wait a minute, what about hunting? What about farming? What about protection? And they're right, it's totally valid. And the same thing comes with cigarettes, that we could say to people, hey, smoking will kill you, and it creates huge extra public costs because of the healthcare implications. That wouldn't stop people from smoking, especially addicts who, you know, may not have the free will or free choice when it comes to smoking because they're addicted. And that's where I prefer harm prevention strategies. Like, I don't think that everyone should be on drugs all the time, but I do think that all drugs should be legal so that we have a better strategy of dealing with addiction and preventing the black market from controlling what ends up being a very popular pastime within society. So I think, you know, public education, public health, and persuading or negotiating with people to not smoke is far more effective than trying to force them not to smoke. Because part of the reason I lean libertarian is because I do believe that you can't force people to do anything they don't want to do. Instead, what you need to do is create incentives or help people make up their own mind as a far more effective strategy of getting the outcome that you desire.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I wasn't advocating that line of reasoning. I was just saying if you hand over your agency to a savior state, then you hand over your free will with it. I mean, that just kind of comes with the social contract, I guess.
But it strikes me that no one other than people like us who indulge in political philosophy would see that as such a black and white negotiation. I think most people have a hypocritical or even ignorant approach where they think they can have their cake and eat it too. They think that they can rely upon the state for some things, but not others. And what if they're right and we're wrong? What if you can have a gradient version of a social contract that includes some things and not others? I think that's part of why political parties exist. Some like guns, some don't like abortion. And they don't see the contradiction that exists between those two policies.
I'd like to jump in here with kind of introducing, I think, a topic that kind of ties what you guys are talking about together, which is Taleb's concept of anti-fragile, which I had to reread recently to make sure I got it right, right? Because it's one of those kind of handy things you can kind of refer to and not really understand it. And I was in danger of doing that. And so Taleb's point with his anti-fragile word is, he says it's not resilience. A resilient system can take some body blows and take some volatility or shocks to the system, and it can survive in its current state. that's resilience, at least as he's presenting it. He said an anti-fragile system gets better the more it's shaken up, the more volatility there is, the more shocks it gets hit with. It then uses that to adapt to becoming a better, stronger, more effective system. And so I think to Jesse's point about democracy, I think that to me, the potential of democracy is to be anti-fragile. In other words, it can take all the blows and all the variety of stimulus and the unknown unknowns, and it can come up with something that's better. It's not just going to survive. It can actually become a better system if there's enough inputs, you know, and that's what we're talking about is if you strip away all the inputs and there's only like a dominant narrative and a handful of corporations and, you know, that kind of thing, you've stripped away all the inputs and then you've got a fragile system. And so, and to, then just kind of to go back to my airliner thing, because we've all sat in a plane, right? And you're sitting in this tube and it's flying at a horrendous rate of speed, right? I mean, almost, you know, 550 miles an hour at 35,000 feet. And that's what it's designed to do. Doesn't work well. If you go too much higher than 42,000 feet, the engines flame out and you crash. You know, if you're flying at 1,000 feet, it's just not engineered aerodynamically to last very long. You're going to run out of fuel and crash. And so now we've got this system where we really aren't allowed to have a functioning democracy or an anti-fragile economy, because that will crash the status quo elites who are in charge. And so I'll just kind of sketch out a few things. Now in the current system, we cannot have the stock market crash to anything lower than what it is right now. That's impossible, because if it does, it bankrupts all the pension funds and all the wealthy people who, you know, support the political status quo. Then you can't have 30 million people that without a job. You know, in other words, you lose 30 million jobs, the system doesn't work because those people's wages paid all the taxes. So then what you have to do is say, well, then we're going to print endless trillions to, you know, fill the hole left by those wages. And you go, well, then that unleashes other consequences. And so to me, it's like there's no way the aircraft can stay in this thing, because one of those things is going to break it apart. Either the market's going to crash anyway, 30 million jobs are not coming back and they can't be filled with borrowed money forever without creating inflation, where the system can survive fine when inflation's in assets, which is what we've had for 20 years. System doesn't work well if it's in real world goods and services, you know? So that's kind of where I'm seeing that the thing is so fragile now that the way to keep the aircraft inside that thing is now creating its own distortions, which just aren't sustainable. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's why I think that this crisis could possibly be the terminal crisis of this super cycle. I don't mean the end of civilization. I mean the end of the monetary system, the way it's structured, the end of, I don't know what you want to call it, not neoliberalism, but just the end of, I suppose, credit-induced financial booms. I think the previous cycles, the last cycle, 2008, was our last best chance to say, okay, no bailouts, everyone who's over-leveraged goes down with the ship, stronger, you know, the equity gets wiped out on anyone who, let's say there is a bailout, the equity gets wiped out, just some sort of like, now we're going to wring out all of these inefficiencies in the system and we're going to build from a more solid footing. I think 2008-09, that was our last opportunity to do it. What we have now, I don't think he can do it now. I don't think he can say, well, let's just, you know, nobody gets bailed out and let the people, you know, let the weak hands die. Doesn't work now, because now it's not just Lehman Brothers and Goldman Sachs and BlackRock. They're not the ones who are going to get wiped out if we let this thing go. It's the 30 million lost jobs are just the beginning. It's everyone who's got a mom and pop pizza parlor, salon, car wash, whatever. It's like, well, you know, if those guys get wiped out, they can't just go out and build a new hedge fund in 6 months and be back in, you know, back in business. So I really do I hate to use the word sympathize, but I really do understand why there is so much will to keep the system on the rails right now, because there really is no other alternative right now. But I don't think it's going to work. I think it's as Charles says, we're at this point now where all of these machinations to keep this economy within this narrow band are creating their own distortions. You have negative prints on oil. You have what was the other like really anomalous thing that just happened recently? You had a whole bunch of ETFs blew up before the negative print on oil, and just things like that are just telling us that, you know, even the inputs that used to produce a certain output in the past is not producing those outputs anymore, and it's kind of an all bets are off situation, and I really don't know what it looks like on the other side of this.
Well, and I think that almost brings us back full circle, because, you know, what I find fascinating about this current situation is not just the unknowns we don't know about, but I also feel, and I think you both alluded to this, that there's going to be a lot of knowns that we're going to actually discover were unknowns all along, that there were a bunch of things we thought we knew that we didn't, that we were wrong about, that our perception in the old scenario is gone, and from the new scenario, we have a different perspective. And that's why I find this particular period of uncertainty kind of leveling, because it's almost as if everyone is equally uncertain. Whereas in previous situations, there'd always be an insider, there'd always be someone who knew. And so on the one hand, I think that makes the fanatic support of the status quo so interesting, that there are a fascinating alignment of interests whose only current agenda is to keep Humpty Dumpty together, even though Humpty Dumpty has arguably already fallen. So again, it becomes a perception issue of, are we trying to save something, or is it already broken and instead we're playing this musical chairs around the breakage? And that's where finally I think about the future a lot. And I think about the future, you know, partly because it's theoretically my job, but I also feel that the future is inherently political and speculative, because, you know, nobody ever knows the future. And every time, whether it's the three of us or whether it's in our own personal capacities, you have conversations about the future, there is a real sense of change. There is a real sense of revolution. And, you know, my first response to you, Mark, was to think, you know, but who are the revolutionaries? You know, who are the people to reconfigure the regime, whether a reconfiguration of capitalism or whether something completely different, like crypto capitalism or, you know, distributed society, whatever that may be. There isn't a Bolshevik party. There isn't even a Menshevik party. There is no, you know, government in waiting in the wings other than Facebook. Right. Other than Google,
you might be exactly that.
ByteDance.
You could be exactly correct there.
But I bring that up in part because I don't feel that those companies have legitimacy. I don't feel that those companies have competence. Right. At least the Bolsheviks had control of the Petrograd Army and the Petrograd Navy, and had control of the post office and the telegraph, and had some legitimacy amongst their constituents. Now, while Facebook and Google and Amazon do have similar levels of control, I'm not sure they have the legitimacy, not yet. And I think that's something to watch. But to bring it back to my point about the future and the perception, what is different about this particular moment in history compared to all previous is not only do we have the ability to speculate about the future, but we also have the ability to negotiate about the future. And whether that's future markets, whether that's concepts of futurity in terms of predictive markets and betting on the future, there are all sorts of instruments in place that allow people to negotiate their vision of the future and therefore take action on it. So I could see a nightmare scenario in which Wall Street decides that they have an accurate picture of the future, and therefore they're going to wipe out the airline industry, or they're going to allow for 30 million people to be unemployed, or they're going to allow for certain pensions and not others to go bust, in the sense of picking favorites, as politics often manifests. But I, this is where I'm a little cynical or a little skeptical that we're going to make it through this period and get the change we desire. Because what frustrated me about the lockdown, what frustrated me about the sort of consensus amongst governments that everyone should stay at home, is it was based on a consensus of the future, right? It was a situation in which they created models that predicted the future that may or may not have been accurate, probably were not, but it was that consensus that allowed them to have certainty amidst uncertainty and then go forward with unprecedented policy and action. And so I'm worried that the same thing's going to happen in Wall Street or in Silicon Valley, where these companies are going to come together, come to their consensus of what the future is, and act on it, regardless of whether that future is desirable or possible or fair. And that's where my sort of worry about not so much a revolution, but a mythology of the future could really derail or mess up the dynamics that we're currently.
Did you see that, I think I posted it to my Facebook page this morning, that code review of the Imperial College computer model, that the 2.5 million deaths and 500K in space? Well, so that's kind of speaks to your idea about we have this false consensus of what the future is. The software bugs in this model are kind of atrocious. Like, I would fire any company that presented me this model. Anyhow, so that's, I'll put that in the show notes page. I would push back only slightly on what you said, that we're in this hinge moment where the future is negotiable, because for people who are not well placed, I don't think the future is negotiable. The future is just something that's going to happen to the majority of us.
I mean, I'll just quickly push back. I would say that it is still negotiable. It's just a question of whether their only option is dissent.
Right?
They may not have an avenue to actually form that future, but they absolutely have the ability to say, I dissent. I object to where this is going. And that remains something that all humans have the ability to exercise.
Well, I'll bring that back to this whole idea that I think I'm a little more paranoid about than you are, which is dissent has been sort of co-opted now. It's been marginalized by the corporate media because dissenting voices just kind of get hitched to this wagon of these people are conspiracists, these people are Nazis, these people are all right, and that's kind of, dissent gets lumped into that bucket completely. What you said, or not, you know, for the most part, what you said about there's no one to take the place of the state except maybe Facebook and Google. I mean, you hit the nail so on the head that it kind of sent the chill down my spine. I remember, I mean, I wrote an article when Facebook announced Libra. I talked about how, why that put an existential chill into the minds of the state, because for many people, their Facebook account is more relevant to their day-to-day lives than their passport is, which is issued by the state. And so if Facebook actually came out with a currency, and this is something that I've been saying for over a decade, you know, Steven Zarlinga, Vincent LoCascio, whoever controls the money system controls society. So if Facebook or Google or whoever comes out, says, here's a currency, use this, and that platform is more impactful on your day-to-day existence than your government-issued ID is, then Facebook wins. Facebook is the next thing. And it reminded me of the whole 1984 model, the book in the middle of the book within the book in 1984, the hidden manual of the resistance, which said, you know, there are three classes to society, the people who run it, the people below the people who run it, who want to switch places with them, and then the underclass on the bottom. And so in this, we're at this hinge point in history where that second level that wants to reverse places with the top level are the big tech platforms and the huge multinational corporations who are saying, okay, well, let's, your time is over, just let us, we'll take it from here.
Yeah, I Jesse, I like your idea that politics is a key element in the future. And I think that's often underappreciated, because politics is like culture. It can change glacially, right? And then it can change very rapidly. And so I see that as a hopeful potential. In terms of people's response to being essentially politically powerless, I mean, history tells us, if we look at like the collapse of empires, people just opt out. That was, you know, they leave, they vote with their feet or whatever. So they leave Rome, you know, the bread and circuses is no longer free. So they go and work at a monastery or something. They find some other way, right? And they don't, they're not a resistance. They're not dissenting, and nor do they present another option for a state. They just opt out. And I think that's going to be a huge movement going forward, as people just, we're talking about rural communities or changing communities or starting communities, and it's all like people are just going to say, you know what, I don't have any energy to fight, you know, Facebook or the state or anything else, so I'm just going to go off and just, you know, find another way, find another arrangement. But I also want to talk about, bring in the monetary system that Mark mentioned. When we look at critical hinge moments in history, such as like the French Revolution is a classic, because what caused the actual, you know, tearing down of the Bastille and all that? Well, bread prices were soaring, right? Because there were shortages. They'd messed up the monetary system, you know, by overprinting and squeezing people too hard for taxes and all that stuff. And so if we get a runaway type of inflation where people can no longer afford their lifestyle, even with credit and the giveaways from the government, then you get a revolution of some kind. It's really that simple. and so it, and this is where, Mark, your point about Facebook controlling the money, that is that would be scary, because it's all like, oh, well, you know, your fiat currency issued by the states getting worthless. Oh, but our currency is still holding its value. Yeah. And that would be very strange. And so I'm always hoping for a decentralized version of an alternative money. One that my little pet project is that it's actually labor based. Like the currency is created by creating value in your community, and as opposed to a tech giant or the state. And maybe something like that could, again, if it has a cultural element to it, then suddenly it can sweep through and trigger political change that was not possible like 5 years before.
Can I just jump in very quickly, clarify or not point, is point to what Charles is talking about is a system he dubbed Climb, which he outlined in A Radically Beneficial World. Is that the book? That was the first book I did the audio book for. And it goes back to something we talked about in a podcast, one of the podcasts we did for the audio books, which was, we don't see that there's going to be some big come to Jesus moment for the state or the challengers to the state to say, well, we're not going to do it this way anymore, we're going to do it this way. It's more of a gradual but building loss of momentum, loss of relevance around the core institutions that we organize our societies around, because people are doing exactly what you say. They're opting out, and they're just, well, I have this relationship going with these people in my community, and this is how I exchange my labor and my services and my assets now. And that just begins to pick up steam and take on a logic and a configuration of its own. I did actually have a question, because I was rereading the Climb section the other day, and I'm thinking, how is Climb different from MMT in the sense that you are issuing currency on the basis of economic value in the system, which is what MMT tries to do or says they're going to do. They say they're not going to print modern monetary theory. So very briefly, Charles's system, Climb, it's you're generating sort of currency measurement based on actual productive labor being done in the community. Modern monetary theory says, and there's some debate as to whether modern monetary theory is a prescription model that says this is how governments should do things, or if I think Mosler, as originally described MMT, was basically saying this is the way it works now and this is why we can never go broke. And what it says is that a government that prints currency, that has the ability to print its own currency, can never default on its debt. And the way they say we make sure it doesn't become inflationary is because we only print enough currency to track the GDP of the economy. So you're never going to overshoot that. That's MMT in a nutshell.
Yeah, good description. Jesse, do you want to step in before I talk about the currencies?
No, go ahead, Charles.
Oh, thanks. Okay, so to me, again, we've often talked about the hierarchy here of power. MMT is currency created from the top down. You know, some experts, and again, going back to Jesse's work on talking about humility and magic bullets, you know, the idea that somebody up there in the Federal Reserve or the MMT, you know, hierarchy is going to decide how much the society or the economy is outputting. And it's only going to print exactly that right amount of money, right? And then it's going to distribute it evenly to all the people that don't have enough. And it's all like, well, wait a minute, where's politics in this? Politics vanished, right? It's like in politics, the money's created and distributed to people who have political power. So, you know, the whole point of the Clime system, and I'm glad you brought this point up, Mark, because it may look like superficially like the same thing. You're creating money out of thin air. No, I'm not. With the Clime system, what we're actually referring back to is something that was used in the Middle Ages when gold and silver were scarce before the discovery of all the silver in the New World by Spain, which flooded Europe with this huge amounts of new currency, right? Before that, if you went to a trading fair, very few people had any gold or silver coins, right? I mean, they were still using coins from hundreds of years before. So you used bills of exchange, and it was basically a form of paper money. But it was not just paper money like the way our money is fiat that's created out of thin air. It was connected to the delivery of a good or service. So I generated a bill of sale to you because I brought my 10 chickens, which you bought and traded like to me for, you know, some iron tool, right? And so it's like we exchange value, but we created a currency. And maybe it only lasted as long as the trading fair, or it in other cases it went on for years. And I brought the piece of paper to the trading fair a year or two later, and it still retained its value because of the trust and confidence within that system, right? So the Clime system's like that. You create value in your community, you get a unit of currency, right? Because you've actually done something that has value. Where the MMT thing is they're sort of just, you know, pulling a GDP thing out of thin air, essentially. Like, well, how do we define that, right? And in the Clime system, the community defines what's valuable. What's scarce in the community? Well, you're filling that scarcity or addressing that scarcity, then we grant you, you know, this currency, you know, and that's kind of a democratic, decentralized method of creating currency.
And tangible. I mean, what I like about that system is on a conceptual basis, it's accessible to most people. It's something that they can wrap their heads around. It's something that they can engage. Versus, I almost feel that one of the lessons we ought to be taking from this crisis is that too much complexity is a bad thing. That, you know, when you create these systems that depend upon increasingly specialized experts to explain them, it's not surprising when they fail. Whereas I really like that concept of the anti-fragile system, the evolutionary system that gets stronger and stronger with each failure. That, you know, responds to crises by increasing its capacity and increasing its adaptability. I think one of the reasons that we have not been able to achieve that is we've embraced and even encouraged levels of complexity that prevent comprehension amongst most people. And I think that's a mistake. I think that if we are going to come up with a decentralized financial system that is, you know, socially just, let alone anti-fragile, then it has to be accessible, that people have to be able to understand it. And to me, that's kind of one of the symptoms of why our democratic system has failed or atrophied or collapsed, is because it got to a point where people just didn't understand it. You know, they didn't understand how when they voted for one person, that person's policies were never reflected in the actions of the government, or the way in which the cliche has become that, you know, a candidate campaigns on one issues and then governs completely differently. You know, it not only breeds cynicism, I think it breeds confusion. I think that either, you know, to your earlier point, Charles, either people withdraw and they say, I've got no time for this nonsense, or they just come to very cynical conclusions. I mean, it's all corrupt and all politicians are corrupt. Whereas I think, you know, part of the problem is literacy. Part of the problem is public education, that we need our systems to be comprehensible to the people who use it. And if not, that's when you end up breeding dysfunction. Because I think of that in the context of the internet. The internet works great when the app or the protocol or the service is self-evident, when it's transparent, when it's based on protocols and open source standards that allow everyone to understand it, even if it is slightly above their technical level, versus black box systems that nobody understands, that are indecipherable and that cannot be scrutinized. This is, to me, part of the reason why we found ourselves in this mess, because that's when you get, as in 2008, complex mortgage instruments that nobody understands and therefore become a ticking time bomb. Or in our current context, the inability to anticipate threats to the system that cannot easily be contained, but instead reflect the power of nature to transcend containment, to even transcend, to a certain extent, our own comprehension, that should be a warning that we should keep our system simple, stupid, as the old phrase might be.
You know,
Mark,
I was.
You want to wrap it up?
Well, I don't know if I can. I don't know if this is wrap up worthy, but I will say, it was why I was so optimistic about cryptocurrency when it came out, the whole decentralization, because it really, especially in the face of a lot of skepticism and hostility, it did seem to demonstrate that anti-fragile. It just kept getting bigger and more pervasive the more it was attacked and the more it was denigrated and that sort of thing. But it brings me full circle as well to a note that I had earlier on. I think in Charles's opening comments, I made a note about how, or maybe it was also Jesse's comments, with Ethereum. I remember I was taking part in the Ethereum name service working group, and they were trying to design a domain registry based on smart contracts on the blockchain. And you know, we all know that the domain name system is what I've been working in for the last, you know, over 20 years. And I was trying to impart my years of experience to what they were doing, and they were kept coming up against this roadblock where it was, they couldn't create a smart contract that captured all of the range of possibilities of bad outcomes in a domain name system. We're talking about censorship at that point. It's like, okay, so we don't want to allow child porn domains. What else? And everyone's like, well, how do you even code that into a smart contract? How do you code in? Anyway, it brought it down to incentive structures. What is desirable? What is undesirable? Because there were some people who thought it was a foregone conclusion that you don't want domain speculation going on in this system, until someone else would say, well, how do you know you don't want domain speculation going on in this system? Isn't that what gives the domains underlying value? And so they realized after a couple days of this that, you know, we can't actually put this all into a smart contract. And if we're running society on a smart contract, the algorithmic society, there's still going to be these outcomes that are unfavorable to everyone. And the big example with the Ethereum community that came up during this conference was the great DAO hack. You know, Ethereum converted itself to a decentralized autonomous organization. They transferred a boatload of Ethereum into it. and the Dow got hacked and someone drained like $500 million out of it. And so what do you do? Because the smart contract says that this was allowed. And so it happened as per the parameters of the smart contract. They ended up forking the entire Ethereum blockchain, which is why you have Ethereum Classic today and you have Ethereum. And what the metaphor they called at the time, they said, that was what made us realize that even on a smart contract, on a global computer, you need the handbrake. You need the big handbrake to just stop the train sometimes. And that's what we don't have, right? That's what we don't have in anything we're doing today. So you have this lockdown logic, we'll call it, where, you know, we have to shut down the entire global economy and no one is able to throw a handbrake to say, well, maybe this was right for a while, for 6 weeks, and now it's not. Or there's no, everything's going under its own logic. It's being impelled by expert models that are coming off of flawed computer algos, and we really have that lack of critical thinking and that lack of just take a step back and just you know, have a second look at this.
I mean, of course, what's interesting about the so-called DAO hack is, as you alluded to, it wasn't a hack. It was actually a feature of the system.
It's not a
feature
bug
that they decided they didn't want to have after the fact.
Yeah.
But I think, if anything, it demonstrates the, you know, the need to be able to disagree with oneself. I mean, I think I said this in one of our first podcasts. One of my favorite Marshall McLuhan sayings is, I don't necessarily agree with what I'm saying. That... You know, maybe we should all have the privilege to think out loud and then disagree with ourselves. And unfortunately, we don't have that in our current culture. But it would be great if governments had that ability, if the state had that ability. Now, I think the irony comes down to, you know, no government, no regime wants to lose power. And often those mistakes do merit them losing power. And so, you know, maybe to bring it back full circle and to wrap up, you know, maybe that's the issue. Maybe we don't currently have the mechanism to throw the current bums out, that the people who are currently in power, whether in the state sense or whether in the economic sense, there is no parking brake, right? There is no stop button. There is no, okay, you guys made your best effort. Why don't we let the next team of bozos in to give it a shot?
There's no accountability.
And I think that's why. Right. And I think that's where we have a current sort of crisis of democracy, is that even in the midst of a war, you should have the ability to change your leadership, especially when that leadership is not doing what you want them to do. I think that's the problem right now. I and other areas have called for the equivalent of a war cabinet. That whether it's bipartisan in the United States or tri or multi-partisan here in Canada, that governments should be looking at unity governments, at trying to find a way in which they can transcend ideology to look out for the best interests of the people. Because I think the alternative is to delegitimize government, is to delegitimize the regimes that are currently in power, because they are messing up, and they're messing up large. And, you know, unless they're able to acknowledge that, unless they're able to address that, maybe Facebook is our future. Maybe Google is our future. Not so much out of choice, but just by default, because there's nothing else out there.
Charles, anything to take us home? Or
I think the, you know, my solution is kind of Marie Antoinette had the right idea. Just let them eat brioche. Which is translated in English usually into cake, but it was actually brioche, right? Because the bread was gone, so why not brioche? I mean, so that's kind of the MMT centralized thing. Let's just create a couple trillion or 10 trillion or 100 trillion, give it away. That'll solve everything. And so that's where we're at right now, is distribute all that brioche and, you know, go, you know, we don't need to do anything else.
Although, to your point, it is encouraging to see the amount of sourdough bakers who have decided to start new hobbies, and that maybe they've realized that if there's any brioche to be eaten, they're going to have to do it themselves. And maybe that's a good moral for us to end on.
I think so.
All right. Okay, guys. I'm going to hit stop here, and that was our salon number 3.